Retro Gaming Radio 2003. Keep it retro.
Wait a minute. This all happened before.
Yeah, this does seem really familiar.
Retro Gaming Radio 2004. Keep it retro.
Prepare to qualify.
Keep it retro. Hello, folks. Welcome to the October 2003 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Shane R. Monroe here, Brian Smith behind the mixing board as always. Welcome to the program. We've got tons of interview material for you, a little flashback review, which should piss plenty of people off, as per always. Frankly, I thought it was kind of funny, but hey, that's me. We also have some more interview material from Bill Kunkel and Howard Scott Warshaw. You guys are going to really like that. Our regular editorial commentary and bits and bytes. So stick around. In the interest of keeping most of the show related for interviews this month, we're going to keep the editorial commentary relatively short. We've talked a little bit about this on the forums, as we've pretty much talked about every topic under the sun, but I did want to kind of make a public discussion about it here on the show. I want to know, when value add supersedes component functionality. And let me explain. You got a blender, right? The blender does one thing. You put crap in it, you turn it on, and it blends it up, right? That's why they call it a blender. If it did something else, they'd call it something else, all right? A watch, right? A watch tells the time. But you can buy watches that have many, many other features built into it. Calculators, personal planners. You can even get an MP3 watch, right? That is taking a component, something that was designed to do something, and expanding its capabilities beyond the original design of the product. I'm not talking about pet stuff like the Game Boy Advance web server, right? We've talked about that in the past. That's just something utilizing a product for something it really wasn't intended to do. That's actually completely different than what I'm talking about right now. And what I'm talking about right now is taking a component and expanding its abilities so far beyond the scope of its original intention that the product itself becomes diluted with the aim to please as many people as possible. The expression jack of all trades, master of none is what I'm talking about. Okay? If the Game Boy Advance evolved from a Game Boy Advance to the Game Boy Advance Plus telephone, right? So now you've got a really cool handheld that has a phone feature to it. You know, now I can't imagine talking into my Game Boy Advance SP, right? So they'd have to redesign it in order to make it more phone friendly. Well, damn it, I like the SP exactly the way it is. It's comfortable, it works good for me. You make it into a phone, you're going to have to alter the design. You know, you're either going to have to increase the price or you're going to have to scale back on what's already there. The people who are looking at the N-Gage, I guess, that are reviewing that product, which is a telephone slant video game, cell phone slant video game, are realizing that the video games just really aren't that good. Things like 15 frames per second, you know, very choppy animation, things like that, right? That's not how you build a product, by dividing. The TV VCR combo is a perfect example. You go down to Albertsons, a supermarket, a grocery store, and they have got an Apex DVD slant television in one unit for like $99, right? Who buys that? I mean, other than some, you know, low-income family, this is the only way they can do it. You take a video file or an audio file or, you know, somebody who's really into this sort of thing and say, hey, what do you think of that? They go, that's trash. Well, of course it is, you know. The sum of the components do not meet up to the sum of the product. And that's a big problem. Componentizing has always been popular amongst, say, the audiophiles. You know, you don't find somebody buying a tuner, tape deck, and CD player in one unit if they're serious about their equipment, right? And that's part of the problem. We're getting to the point to where people want one product that does everything. And the problem with that is is even though it may do everything to some degree, can it do everything properly that a dedicated version of that could not do? I say no. You know, the forthcoming, the PSX or whatever it is that Sony's putting out, right? The all-in-one entertainment center. That's going to be a PlayStation 3, PVR, DVD player. Basically, everything that belongs in your living room is going to go in one box. That makes me as nervous as a cat in a room full of rocking chairs, folks. You know, what happens if the DVD component goes out? What happens if the CD drive goes out? Okay, then you have the PVR functionality, but then you either got to replace the unit, have it repaired, which means you're out every product. The same thing with all-in-one printer, copier, fax machines, right? Say the scanner part of it goes out. Well, you just lost your fax machine, too. Oh, sure, it takes up less space on your desk. What about reliability? What about performance? What about features? Okay, these things are just going right into the wind along with quality, right? And a bunch of other things that modern society dictates that we don't need. Remember when it cost $300 to buy a VCR? I remember the JVC VCR that I bought. $300, four-head hi-fi. Now, granted, this is like, what, $1989, right? But you know what? If somebody hadn't broken into my car and stolen that VCR would still be in service today, right now. I've gone through a Sony VCR. Sony's supposed to be a good name, right? I spent a year with a Sony VCR and it died, right? But I guarantee you if that JVC was here, whoever stole that, whatever living room that VCR is in, it's still working. I guarantee it. I've got three Commodore 1702 monitors here. Old school Commodore 64 monitors, which double as composite monitors for the bedroom and, you know, the other rooms in the house. 20 years later, still works. Is my Wega going to still be working in 20 years? I seriously doubt it. I'd even say that my Kenwood DVD players ain't going to be working in 20 years. I guarantee none of the VCRs I have will be working in 20 years. My GE DVD players? Doubt it. They ain't going to be working in 20 years. Those Commodore monitors? They were JVCs originally, before the Commodore put their name on it. Those are still working. You know? I saw one for $25 at Classic Gaming Expo. I almost had to have it. That's because they built things to last. Now they don't want things to last. You need to buy another one. And the consumer can say, well, you know, when I buy a new one, it's only $60 a hit. If I paid $300 for it, I'd have to basically buy four to match the quality and durability of that other thing, and I get new features. That's the other side of the argument. Every year I get a brand new VCR. Well, damn, every year you shouldn't need a brand new VCR. You know, it's just like software that's supposed to work that doesn't. You know, you could say, well, God, I got all these other features. If this piece doesn't work, well, that's okay. Accepting the deviance of quality. Accepting the concept that we can take a product and basically mutate it into something it shouldn't be. You know? The new Sony handheld, the PSP that's coming out. Handheld-based, but with a CD-ROM. All right? That ain't right, as Chris Rock would say. That ain't right. Because you know that CD-ROM drive, no matter how intelligently they cache it, no matter how well they use it, is going to suck the life out of batteries, suck the life out of the rechargeable, right? CDs were never designed to be put in a portable application. You're lucky you get them in laptops. Have you ever actually used, like, played a movie off a CD or listened to music off a CD on a laptop and just you could almost watch the battery meter drop? I mean, it halves the life of the battery. Even the hard drive doesn't take as much access as the CD-ROM. They're taking the technology to a point where the core's not ready yet. We ain't got batteries good enough to be running CD players on a handheld. Just my opinion. Right? How long does your MP3 Walkman or your CD player play on a set of batteries? 3 hours? That's what mine plays. Mine plays about 3.5 hours on 4 AA's. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. We should really consider the concept of allowing product to go too far beyond value add. Okay, you know, I can understand the Xbox and the PS2 doubling as a DVD player. There's already drive in there. All you need is a little bit of software. That's okay. That's okay. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about taking it beyond that, turning it into something even further that it shouldn't be. If my toaster doesn't need to be on the internet, I don't care how far in the future we go. I cannot ever see my toaster connected to the internet. Plain and simple. Ain't gonna happen. There's no benefit for my toaster to be on the internet. Putting my toaster on the internet is not value add. Putting my toaster on the internet means you're going to cheapen the components you're using to make my bread toasty so that you can put a nick in there. All right? That's what I'm talking about. What do you guys think? You guys think that there's a limit to value add? You think you can continue to bolt things onto a product, pay the same price, and still get the same quality you started off with? Sound off on the forums. Let us know what you think. Next, we're going to go ahead and put Bill Kunkel back in front of the microphone. Bill Kunkel, of course, is one of the founders of Electronic Games Magazine, as well as numerous other periodicals thereafter. Basically, Bill Kunkel and his group pioneered what real video game journalism is all about. For those of you who missed last month, I highly recommend you listen to last month's show before you pick up and listen to part two of Bill Kunkel from Electronic Games Magazine. Bill is also a regular poster on our discussion forums, so you can ask him your questions directly. Bill Kunkel, great guy. Maybe a little too much weed, but a great guy all the same. Let's take it away, Bill Kunkel.
Not from somebody who's a
big
name.
No, it's a small company, but it's a bunch of very famous developers from big companies who got together, created this incredible machine.
Is that the downloadable one, is it?
It's not that Andromeda, or not the Andromeda, Phantom. It's not the Phantom.
Phantom, yes.
Oh, stop it.
You think the Phantom is going to be doing well?
Well, no, but I'm saying you've got a new system there. It's got technological credit. Is it? Well, who makes the Phantom?
It's what's the name of the company? It's
got Andromeda. No,
it's not Andromeda. It's the other one.
Infinium Labs.
Yeah, that is what I'm thinking of.
Those guys are passing the bull every day as they build that machine.
Well,
it's going to fail. It's guaranteed.
Oh, it
to
is.
Fail.
No paying. One's going to buy it. And,
right.
But that, you know, now, obviously, Namco
but why,
has
but
a
why
name.
Are they doing it then? Why can't they just go, oh, what the hell? Okay, I had a bad trip last night. I thought we were going to make everybody pay to download games. All right, let's just start from scratch here. We messed something up. Why don't people see that ahead of time? We all see it.
Well,
they're going
to
go forward and spend like $50 million of investors' cash. Investors are going to go, goddamn video games. and then we're going to have another slap in the face. I don't understand why you can't see it.
I got to tell you, here's a story that'll maybe explain some of it.
Maybe it'll help us out.
There's a guy named Derek Smart, okay? And he created a game, and I'm not going to give you the name of the game simply because I can't remember it. But it was a space colonization game. It got you battle something, something, you know. And he got like, you know, $5 million, whatever, to develop it. I'm making up numbers here. And when it was done, it had some incredible things in it,
right,
technologically speaking, but it had a lot of bugs, okay? And so the company said, we can't spend any more money on it, we're cutting it loose. So he went down the block to the next company, and he said, here's a product, they've already invested $5 million in it. All we need is maybe another $3-4 million, and you're going to get a $9 million machine game when we're finished. So they said, oh, that makes sense. This guy did that to like four or five companies. And every one he had a better argument because he could say, there's been $20 million spent on the development of this game.
And people are thinking $20 million, it must suck.
Do you want to throw that away at this point when you can get it for maybe, I don't know, $3 million? You know, and they would say, yeah, you know, that sounds like a good deal.
But where's the proof of concept of a downloadable game system?
Oh, there is none.
That's what I'm saying. Why would you... If you came to me tomorrow and said, hey, I've already sold out I already have $20 million in investments on this video game system that I have nobody's ever played any of the games, and I've never made video games before in my life.
They got a nice website, though.
And, yeah.
But we got a hell of a front end.
Yeah, my website,
yes.
My website is coming soon, but but you need to get in this on the ground floor. I'm supposed to be like, duh, here's my $20 million too here.
That's how this business works,
but
though.
Why
are people stupid?
Because people are stupid. I mean, you know, just ask the people who do the Stanford Binet, you know, or people who do IQ tests and stuff. You know, what's the average IQ?
After the .com crash, you'd think that people would have it figured out.
How?
But they
all that they figured out from that is we shouldn't invest in dot-coms.
Why I can't figure out why the person is so smart, but people are so stupid.
Yeah, well, it's because the people who are making the decisions They're not like us.
But they had to get the money somewhere to put them in the position.
They don't have the passion for these games.
Yeah, how did they get rich in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
they're investors. They take chances on things based on the pedigree of the people involved. If you can present them. Do you remember Perfect Dark?
Yeah.
Okay? Do you know how many game development companies were started off of people who did a cutscene in Perfect Dark? And they were the leader, they were the CEO of the company. And their credit was Perfect Dark.
Well, I remember the hype behind Perfect Dark.
I remember the game ended up being like, it sucked.
Yeah, yeah. How do you feel about, what's that game, Shenmue?
Yeah, Shenmue.
I applaud diehard game fan. That's like one of the last big reviews they did before they went under, where they just said just that this game is getting all the rage and all the shows, and this is supposed to be the next step in RPGs. We feel it sucks, because we feel that graphics do not make a game. Where is the gameplay?
Yeah,
I do not understand why.
Penny Arcade had that so well done. Basically, they had like a mock-up of the screenshot of the game.
Yeah,
and it's like, I am Shibu. I must rescue my father after I pick up this cup.
Yeah.
And after I play with this kitten. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
Basically, Shibu is real time to the extreme, to where
it's a chore to play it.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I'm supposed to meet this person at 12:30. It's 11:30 now.
I gotta wait around for an hour.
You will wait physically 60 minutes.
You wait for an hour to put.
What was the game? I'm thinking of a game where you were like a ninja, and you're moving around a castle and jumping down. I think Activision put it out, and you were like an assassin. You were coming up behind people. It was a stealth kill game. The idea was to creep up on people. That's not Shenmue, right?
No, that's not Shenmue.
Okay.
Shenmue was like total Japanimation style. It was like it had like a 40-minute intro.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't a 40-minute intro, but you sat there for a long time watching the intro.
Yeah.
And then they made Shenmue 2. They had that for Xbox. Shenmue 2, I think.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to convince me to buy an Xbox. Yeah, great. I didn't like it the first time I played it.
Again, you know, the fact is, you know, the years in this industry, I can't tell you how many people I've seen order games based on the fact that they walked down an aisle at CES and saw a video demo. Now, what the hell does that tell you?
They don't even show the game graphics. They show the cutscenes.
The cutscenes. That's all they show. Well, I mean, look at the new sports games that I see commercials for constantly.
Right.
If I'm not seeing cutscenes, then the game is unplayable.
Right,
because,
right,
you know, right. I'm running this way, and suddenly another camera is taking over, and it's shooting me from the left side. I'm going to be like, what the hell do I do now? It ain't going to work. It doesn't make the game any better. You know, it's throwing in all this time replays and just frills. And that obsession with frills and cutscenes and, you know, they were very successful with Grand Theft Auto, doing commercials that made it look like a movie. Oh, yet it was funny because it's a driving game, and the commercial didn't show any driving. Just showed guys with machine guns killing one another.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm like, wow, this is a driving game. It's a Grand Theft Auto. I'm presuming there's a car in it somewhere. You know?
It's so funny. But, you know, you see that a lot. I mean, when they did, what, Final Fantasy
X? Yeah, I was going to say, what do you think about Final Fantasy?
I have a lot of good friends. Uh-oh. Who, if I really dissed it, They would come down hard on me. I hate Final Fantasy. Okay.
Severely owned.
I hate it. Here's a funny story. I did under a pseudonym because of legal problems. Prima wanted to do an unofficial strategy book on an upcoming Final Fantasy game. It had, of course, already been released in Japan, like a year or so earlier. So they ordered the strategy books in Japanese from Japan. We hired a Japanese professor from UNLV to come in. My wife sat on the floor. Our game tester sat there and played, talking, you know. She's reading stuff, trying to translate it for us out of the Japanese books. We had to get this done in like 2 weeks. The book was like 300 pages. Oh, total nightmare, okay? We're at the end of it, and we've still got problems, okay? We've got words that we don't understand. We keep coming up with, there's somebody, you know, has a rant. And I'm going, is this a ransom? Is this, what is this? And after like 2 weeks working on this, my game tester and I looked at one another and went, oh my God, it's Lance. We then went back and checked all the words that she had given us that sounded like they began with R and substituted an L for them. Then all of a sudden, they all made sense. But the game strategy business is crazy. I mean, when it started out, the game companies had no idea how much money was to be made in this. And they were, 8%, you know, they were more than happy. It was 8% of profits they weren't going to see before. But companies like Prima started making a fortune. So suddenly that percentage, it kept going up and up and up. And then if you were doing a book that had a secondary license, maybe, you know, Marvel Comics or something, then they want another 8 points. And by the time it was over, everybody wanted to do unofficial books. And the problem with doing unofficial books is you're getting no cooperation.
Right,
you're getting
exactly.
No cooperation from the publishers, the developers, nothing.
It's like a constant reverse engineering process.
Constant, and a nightmare.
You know what, I look at the downfall of modern video gaming as starting with strategy guides. Because you know what? As soon as strategy guides start popping up, I started liking games less. It just occurred to me that that was a shift in gaming. I liked games up to a point that all of a sudden, strategy guides. It's sort of like virus software, antivirus software. You got to ask yourself, how do they get copies of viruses
to get
the definitions built before the virus hits the wild? It's like they start making the games complex on purpose to sell a strategy guide.
Well, for example, we did Maximum Carnage, and this was the official version from Acclaim, the Venom Spider-Man game.
Right, I remember that one.
Okay, on Super NES. And we're playing it, and my playtester, who was like, he was part of the original like video game all-stars with Steve Harris, who traveled around the country. His name is Ken Vance. And he says, Bill, this game is... nobody's going to be able to play this game. Nobody. We came to CES. We met with the developers. And we said, oh, we got a couple of questions for you. We're going nuts. And he said, I'm not going to tell you anything.
Well,
and I said, excuse me? And he said, hey, the developers don't make any money off these books.
Why should we help you?
What's my motivation?
Damn.
Is it be a nice guy, you know?
So he was admitting that, made it so hard that...
And, what he didn't tell us was... the version they sent us was double speed.
So we're saying,
you know, be really careful when you make this move because it's almost impossible to execute. And then it comes out at half speed, and of course, any 3-year-old can do it. And it's like, oh my God, take my name off the book, please.
Do you still have those hookups where you can get free software and you got good connections with a lot of companies?
I can get it, but honestly, if I can't review the game, I generally don't ask for it, unless it's something that somebody like I know forever, and it's a game that I'm really hot for. I'm spoiled because from 1978 to 1998, I never had to buy anything.
Oh yeah,
not a game system, not a piece of software.
They were begging, they were dropping.
Oh, how many did I want? You know,
damn.
Would I like to be flown in? You know, I did an interesting interview a while back with a journalism student who was talking to me about ethics in game journalism.
Nice.
And I was hard not to snicker. I was like, well, what? You got a 15, 16-year-old kid, whatever, even a 20-year-old kid, and you tell him, we're going to fly you out here. We're going to put you up at a nice hotel. We're going to buy you meals. We're going to bring you out. You're going to schmooze with the developers. You're going to bond with them. They're going to take you to see the game. They're going to show
you
the development
stuff. Put you in a big, fluffy-ass chair.
Oh, man, life is sweet.
You're going to put caviar next to the thing.
Then go home and write whatever you really think.
Go ahead and just, you know, don't be completely objective.
Absolutely. We wouldn't want to influence you in any way. You like that woman? You find her attractive?
She's yours.
Honey, come here. Ethics, you know, you got to pay people before you got to worry about them having ethics.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and game journalists, how many game journalists come from journalism?
Right, none of them.
I was going to ask you about that, too. Is that now a requirement? Do you have to be a journalism major to get a job at these major magazines now? Okay, thank you.
You have to graduate high school? and I sit and play with the Elite Xbox.
You stay home from my school and spend that time playing video games.
Well, see, here's my question. Where the hell did death in video games come from? That word death. Everything has to be deep now. Everything has to be...
Yeah, everything has to be so freaking deep. If you don't have to use at least 7 buttons, the game is not worth the media it's printed on.
I remember reading EG. I'm like, wait a second. When I used to read EG, I never saw anything about death and it had to be environmental and I had to be... What's the terms they use now in magazines that you have to be... Involved, immersed. You have to be immersed in the game.
Yeah,
the game
has to be
deep
enough.
And it has to have a storyline.
Every game
has
to have a story.
You guys never say any of that crap. Well, where the hell did that come from?
Well, it came from an advance in the technology to where they could. I mean, think about a game like Myst. I mean, it isn't even a game, really. The idea is they're putting you in an environment. They're immersing you in the environment, and they're allowing you to explore it. And if it's an interesting environment, it's a fun kind of entertainment. But as with anything else, when it becomes the only thing, you know, it's like fighting games,
right.
Okay? And I testified as an expert witness for Data East when Capcom sued
them. Oh, you did. You did.
Yeah, over Fighters History, I think it was
called. Yeah, that's what it was.
And, Data East was kind of nervous because I wasn't a super game player, you know, and I wasn't going to be able to pull off all these super death moves and everything else on the machine. So they're paying me like $4,000, $5,000 a day, and they spent 2 days for a game expert to come in and tutor me on the machine. And
damn.
It's like, I never found any fun in having to, you know, spin...
Me
the direction
either.
Control, backward and forward, tap the A button 3 times,
see,
hit the
I
top
believe,
button 4 times.
I believe
times.
That's where strategy games originated from.
It is. Well, exactly. And
you can never, ever do a fatality with this character unless you have either someone who's bought the strategy guide.
Yes.
Or owns.
But no, I agree that it was like, it almost became a prerequisite in the development of the game that it had to be complicated because otherwise you couldn't sell the rights to a strategy book.
Exactly.
Oh,
or
unlockables.
Unlockables. That's the thing that just makes me want to beat somebody's ass. Don't tell me I can play 2 characters, but I got to unlock 17 of them.
Yeah.
And I have to unlock the first 16, play all of those all the way through, then to get the 17th character open, then I can actually see the cool stuff in the game. To me, that's like making me watch a 500-minute intro before I get to start the game.
I've known... what's the name? Boone and Tobias, the Mortal Kombat guys.
Yeah.
I've known them since forever.
Is it their fault? Did they start this crap?
Well, what happened was, I remember I was at the big coin op show in Chicago, the AMOA.
Yeah.
And I did it, and Roger Sharp, who is an even older friend, and was president of Midway, says, you know, I'm going to give you an exclusive interview with these guys on the development of MK2. So I talked with them, and they were like, we got stuff embedded in this game that people are going to be discovering 2 years from now. Secret stuff in here. And I'm okay, that's pretty cool. The game was out, I think, 2 weeks.
Everything
was out. It was on all the sites. It came out the next month in all the magazines. They were devastated. They were devastated. They had spent so much time putting hidden characters and hidden powers and all this other hidden stuff in there to make you... And which makes sense with a coin op because you want people to keep coming back.
Oh, yeah. With a coin op, it's like almost a requirement. I can understand that. You got to have a hook.
Exactly. I mean, but, you know, there's a huge difference between I got to reach in my pocket and these days take out a little credit card and put it in.
Yeah.
Or I sit home and I go, reset, you know, that's a huge shift, and it makes a huge difference in how you look at the game. That's the reason, why do you think there have never been Doom-style games in the coin-ops?
There's no way to really make a lot of endless money on it, other than by time.
There isn't. You'd have to literally say, when 10 minutes are up, the game is over, and see how long good players will stand for that.
Oh, yeah.
Because the idea was you played as long as your skill allowed you to.
Right, and you can't play, if you, there's no skill involved in a time limit.
No. Of course not. It was, you know, how high a score can I get? But that's, you're playing totally different type of game.
Well, yeah. See, now, you know who like, took that model and perfected it? Was Atari Coin-Op. When they did Super Sprint, when they did Gauntlet,
yes,
it was like you begged to put money in that machine. Yes. I rolled up freaking wheelbarrows filled with quarters.
Put in another quarter. Are you ready to put in another quarter? I hope you got some ready.
Goddamn, I'll put in more quarters. I don't want to lose all my power-ups on my car.
I got to stack. Give me more quarters. And that's genius.
That's
to show that you would be compelled to just keep playing and keep playing.
You're being rewarded.
Yes.
You know?
You're getting things. You're getting powers.
Gauntlet even told you were going to get screwed if you didn't put in more money.
No.
All of your powers will be lost.
Right.
You're like, oh, hell no. Get that coin back in.
And then
they screwed you even better. They did you even better by turning down your health as the game, as you got better.
Yes.
It's like, you bitches.
Yep.
You've already got me hooked.
Yep.
What am I supposed to do now?
Was that Gauntlet 2 where you build up everything, and if you died and didn't put a quarter back in, all your buddies could go and capture your corpse and gain all your powers back?
Oh, yeah.
That was, I think, the most
the
evil
scavengers.
Thing.
Scavengers. Oh. Yeah. And they'd be waiting, hoping you were going to run out of quarters.
They'd
be lurking around you.
That's when cooperative play really went into the crapper because people were going, okay, I need the next food. I need the next food. Hey, I need that.
Yeah.
He's like, you die, bitch. I want your potion.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Do you believe that kids actually sit at home and try to figure out those moves themselves and then mail the magazines and then mail it into magazines?
Yes.
You really do?
Yes. I believe that because I know that kids have absolutely limitless energy, time on their hands, and it was that whole conquest mentality. How long did it take you to conquer the game? I mean, no one could conquer Asteroids or Missile Command.
Yeah, there was no way to beat.
You couldn't beat the game.
You could only strive to be better.
Exactly. And now the mentality of these kids who grew up on the platform games is they got to beat the game. And they want to race to be the first one in there. And believe me, the magazines love it. Free stuff coming in over the transom. All I got to do is test it and make sure it works.
I mean, it's amazing that somebody figured out A, B, B, A, B, A.
Isn't it,
up,
though?
Down, left, right, left.
Think of all the things they tried before they actually hit on that right button.
That's what I say, because they randomly hit buttons like, oh, shoot, I got it to work. And then they have to go and retrace their tracks.
Do the math. Do the exponential possibilities of four directions and six buttons.
Do you know how much of the strategy books I wrote I simply stole off those internet sites?
Oh, yeah.
If they were willing to do the work, I was more than
happy to take
it. I am
more than happy to publish it for you.
I mean, it's just a fact now. You don't own it, you know?
Right.
No, I do believe they do. I actually do. And incredible as that may seem, you know, but then they discover girls. They don't have time to do that nonsense
anymore.
I've got to
get the strategy guide so I can beat my buddies.
Yeah.
What do you think, what are your opinions of multiplayer gaming past and present? And even future? I mean, in the old days, you and your buddy whipped up a bowl of popcorn, you plopped in front of your 13-inch color TV, it was all fuzzy because your RF cable was kind of melted up. Did I say melted up?
Yes, you said you said up.
Because it was all, you know, you had this wrapped up in aluminum foil so that you could get a better signal. You got that. There was a camaraderie. When he stole your food, you reached over and beat his ass. You know? When you needed help, you know, you could reach over. And now, it's like, it's totally anonymous. There's nothing to make people want to be with other people.
Just go back to something as primitive as Warlord.
That was one of the classics.
Warlord, a phenomenal four-player game.
Absolutely. Maybe one of the best four-player games ever.
And, you know, see, what happened, at one point there was a study done, and I think the arcades learned that the most common combination of visitors that they were getting were two guys and a girl. So remember, all of a sudden there were all those three-player games? There were a ton of
interesting, there were a lot of three-player games.
There were a lot of them, and they all came out right after a point where they said it's three-player groups come in, and they all want to be able to play.
Why did I ever see that?
And that was one of the weird things that caused that. But I think that right now, I mean, there are obviously lots of people who are totally hooked on Diablo Online and EverQuest and stuff. I did some work under contract for Westwood on Earth and Beyond, so I don't know if I should say it's a piece of shit, but...
No, you shouldn't. Bad, Bill,
I
bad.
I didn't say that.
Bad. Oh,
I
Bill.
Didn't say that. There's a ventriloquist around here.
Puppet.
Yeah, puppet.
But, you know,
I said that.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy. No, the real problem is that what's fun about that experience is the communal nature of it. It's very hard to have a communal nature when 40,000 people are playing. On the other hand, look at something like Lineage, Lord British's game that's over on the Pacific Rim, where they have millions of users online playing. Millions! There have been shootings. Somebody killed somebody else's character. The guy got in a car, went over and killed him. That's a game.
You're willing to kill your friend for your game.
Oh, hell, that's a
that's
game.
That's multiplayer. I want in on that.
Now, it's my belief, this is something I literally can't disclose on because I've already been paid a lot of money. But I had an idea for a game, a multiplayer game, that I felt would absolutely be a killer app. And I'll be happy to share the secret of it. The secret of it was going to be that the prime... other things would happen, but the game was centered around the players getting together in between their adventures, let's say,
right,
and talking about it. Sitting in a bar and, you know, and also I think you have to use a lot more hired players. Players who are there with a specific role, who have a script, that this is your character, this is how you should behave. You have freedom to type it in and, you know, your own language and stuff, but this is who you are and you're playing this character. I think you need those players salted in liberally among the regular gamers to direct them, to make sure they're having fun, to make sure some guy, it isn't the equivalent of a guy at a party standing in a corner,
right,
looking down at the floor. Because you enter a game and you're in a room with, you know, 1,000 people.
They don't let you ride the Ferris wheel without someone in charge.
Exactly. I mean, so all I'm doing is dealing with non-player characters. And I wrote the dialogues for those non-player characters. And they're basically, the non-player character is there to give you some information.
Right.
And you can screw around with the player to a certain extent that he's got to figure out that if he presses this button, you'll respond positively. And if he comes on this way, you'll respond negatively. There's little design tricks you can play to make it interesting. But I don't think it's intrinsically interesting to deal exclusively with non-player characters. And that's what you're really doing. You're in a room surrounded by all these virtual players who represent real people, but you're not interacting with them. You're interacting with somebody who was programmed and is working off a written script,
right,
on a flowchart. And that's, until you can beat that, until you can come up with something that would make people say, I would like to do that, then I think you're limited to like 30, 40,000 users who just happen to like that type of game.
Yeah, there's definitely a human element missing.
Yes.
From online video gaming.
The human,
it's not because there's not humans
the
there.
No, there's tons of them. There's,
you know,
thousands
what it is?
Of them.
In all honesty, people have... I mean, basically, think of it this way. Let's say you and I are sitting there playing golf and I take your food.
Yeah.
You're going to reach over and smack me in the head.
Yeah.
That's my carrot. That's my
right.
carrot to play nice.
Mm-hmm.
If yes. I get online and I've got a cheat or a hack, or I'm a lifer dog and I know I can beat your ass or whatever... there's no repercussions for me playing in the direction that the game was designed to be made.
Except what if I could then go to your superior, who is in fact not a non-player character, but is a real human actor, and say, Shane's screwing with me, man. You know, I thought, you know, you guys told me you'd look out for me, and he's stealing my food. And the guy can say either, go screw yourself, pissant, get out of here. He can say, well, I'll tell you what, you do something for me, I'll take care of this problem, I'll make the Shane problem go away.
Freaking mafia. See, I'd play that. I'd play a mafia oriented game like that.
That's Grand Theft
Auto
3 online.
Wouldn't you? I mean, what, you could build
yourself.
They're
going to mess that up, though. Definitely.
They have already. I mean, there have been mafia games, The Godfather and stuff.
Well, I mean, like, they're talking about Grand Theft Auto 3, they're going to do an online edition.
Yeah.
Grand Theft Auto 3 is not a multiplayer game. No, plain and simple.
I think it'll work if you do a riot mode where people can just lose their minds and just go crazy and kill each other.
Then it becomes a first person shooter.
Yeah.
Where are the weapon caches? Where are the respawn points? And how do I gain an advantage over the other people?
Yeah.
Unless, like you said, there's a moderator that says, unless there's a human that says, that son of a bitch is sitting in a sniper spot, I'm going to go take care of him.
This is getting ridiculous. This player is ruining it for a bunch of other players. So I'm going to step in and intercede, and I have the power to do that, you know. So I'm going to call up Joey Three Thumbs and tell him, and you're going to get an email from Joey Three Thumbs who tells you, you know, guess what? You screw with my boy again, and
you're doing lunch.
I break your fingers.
You know, so that's
interesting to have. A mentor system in a multiplayer game is a very interesting concept. I'd be willing to look at it again objectively and say I'd be interested in seeing how that works out.
Because you can control it. If it starts to skew one way or another, you've got people.
They have moderators and chat rooms, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, that's why there are ops in IRC chat rooms, to keep the peace.
And make things work out. You don't think there wouldn't be people who would be willing to do this for free for unlimited time?
Power hungry people?
They're the bosses. They're starting
I
off
the boss
in a high
of
position.
You.
I mean, you could just get people, they'd fall over, they'd kill one another to get that opportunity. So I think that you need more humanity in every sense in these games. Or they're just, you know, they're just glorified one-player games with a bunch of other humans around who might as well just be shadows.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree that could work out in the future. I still personally like to have the guy in the room that I can throw something at him if he pisses me off.
That's evil.
Yeah.
I adore my 64.
I would wear that.
Except, I know you would.
That's what she's showing it to you.
You know, because you could throw something at the guy and it could turn out, you know, he's got a brother.
There you go.
Well, I mean, I don't think people are not near each other.
There should be consequences. Just as in simulation in reality, there must be consequences.
It's a matter of there is no responsibility. If you're completely anonymous, you're completely outside of the system. There is no reason whatsoever for you not to cheat,
right?
Not to be a lifer dog, and not to abuse other players.
Yes.
If there's someone with you, even if you're in the next room, hooked up in a LAN party, that guy can still come over and smack you around.
Well, you know, and again, socialization.
Aren't you Magnolia 69?
Socialization of gamers has been something that's been very difficult to achieve over the years. I remember. Do you remember something called? Cafe Carib, I think it was called. Do you remember the C64's Q-Link?
Yeah, Habitat.
It eventually became AOL. It was called Habitat originally.
Yep, I remember.
It was developed
that.
By the guys who went on to become Lucas.
Right.
And did Monkey Island and all those games.
Right.
Well, while they were beta testing it, they found out that a bunch of teenage guys would get together and commit like virtual rape and mayhem on the female characters. And it was like, how do we control that? That was a can of worms they weren't going to open. So when Carib eventually came out, it was a much more limited, much less interesting experience as a result. But that was where the whole interface for all those Monkey Island games and Maniac Mansion and everything was developed, basically.
That's funny.
So what do you think happened to the adventure game?
Well, I haven't cared a whole lot. I'm not a fan of traditional adventure games. I hated text adventures. Okay. I mean, the best text adventure games are the ones where you have amnesia. Because then there's at least an excuse for why I'm waking up on the beach. I have a hotel room, but I don't know where it is. I've got to spend the first 3 hours of the game finding my friggin' hotel room, then finding out where the light switch is so I can see something in my room, and just finding the right noun verb commands to get me there. You know, it's not like just go to my room, right? I know where my room is.
Go room.
I don't care how drunk I am. I know where my room is. Go to my room. I got it on my key. You know,
that's
and
funny.
Get key, get key, then go room.
Yeah, and it was never that simple. It was the key was always, you know, on the little dwarf, you know, who you had to catch.
Under
you
the
know.
It was hidden under the doghouse.
Yes, well, you had to find the stick, and then you had to find the chewed piece of bubble gum and put it on the end of the stick, take stick, put down vent, grab key, pick up key. I don't recognize that command.
Let me tell you something that was the most clever thing I've ever seen in a text adventure. Even you will have to admit, this is badass. It was in one of the Infocom games. Those are the only ones that ever did them right anyway.
Right.
There was a machine, and they wouldn't tell you what it was. So that would piss you off. But part of the fun was figuring out what this thing did. It was actually fun. It was called the E-Off machine. It was E-Off machine. That's what it's called. You looked in your inventory, the E-Off machine.
Right.
You go, what in the hell is this? Look, E-Off machine. This is the E-Off machine. Well, god damn it. So you like, somebody said, what if I can put something in it? So you put something in it. You know, put so-and-so in E-machine. E-Off machine. Okay, it's in there. Okay, use E-Off machine. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. You're, what the hell? So then you take the item back out. It's like, but the item that you put in there is not the same stuff you put that you put in there. And you're like, what the hell? It turns out that whatever you put in there, it strips the E off the end of the name.
Ah.
So it's an E-Off machine. So if you put a cane in there, it came out a can.
Right.
And I was like, well, damn it. I mean, it pissed me off, but that was pretty damn cool.
It's like a mystery, you know? It's a good mystery if at the end you go, oh, that was so obvious. I should have seen it.
Yeah.
That's what makes it good.
That's what makes it good. And it, but those solutions were few and far between.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree.
Adventures. I mean, and again, when so much of the puzzle was, what noun and what verb do they want me to use to do this obvious thing?
You know what we used to play Infocom games for is to see what we weren't supposed to do that they let us do. Like Deadline, it was a murder mystery.
Yeah, I remember.
You walk to the house, and Mrs. Rourke is in the living room. So you walk in and you're going, I wonder if I can rate Mrs. Rourke. Rate Mrs. Rourke. And dude, you could do it! And it's like a cloudy vision goes over your head.
Right.
You know you're not supposed to be doing this, but you can't help it. Then the police come. I mean, dude, it's like, they let me do that. That was way cool. I mean, I went to jail and I lost the game, but that was neat. I could do it.
And I mean, I designed several adventure games. They were what was called illustrated text adventures, where there would be the, you know, the
split screen action with
the graphic and
top,
the text
yeah.
on the bottom. And you know, I'm not ashamed of them or anything, but they it's just I don't like to be frustrated.
Exactly.
I'm not a puzzle. I'm a game guy. I'm not a puzzle guy.
You don't like to work when you play games.
I don't.
Exactly right. Games should be fun to play, not work.
They got to be intuitive for me.
I don't understand why The Sims does so well. Why do I want a simulator of real life?
Of life.
Why don't I just live?
If I want to live, I'll just go live.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, again, it's like we're going back to the dairy farms.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly right.
Sim dairy farm. Sim ant. I've always wanted to be an ant.
I know that's what I fantasize
screen.
About.
Really.
Now, I understand the concept of wanting to do a drive-by and, you know, kill the guy that stopped in the parking lot in front of you.
Absolutely.
I understand that. That makes sense to me.
I played Sim Tower. That was like the end of me playing Sim games. Because I'm like,
dude,
this
it started
is no
getting
longer
stupid.
Yeah,
it started getting stupid. They had Sim. What the heck? Once I saw that, it's like, oh, hell no. What was it? Give me some really odd Sim game. I mean, they were actually door like, Sim.
Symphony?
Symphony.
Sim what?
Symphony.
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 Sim Sim.
Symphony.
You actually it's a sim game where you write Sims.
Yeah. Well, and of course, though of course, you know, the new one, The Sims, is
that's what I was just saying, yeah.
As successful as any game has ever been.
Yeah.
But
online version was a failure.
Why do you think that why are people wanting to play this crap?
I guess it's like the reason people like to read Stephen King horror stories. They take place in a world that they can recognize as being close enough to the world that they live in to make it. A lot of people, and I think especially female players, don't like the idea of going into an immersive environment that's too weird, where there are monsters popping out the doors and things like that. The idea of a more sedate, a more social kind of paradigm is more appealing. And I mean, when we started publishing electronic games, 2% of our readership was female. Now, I've seen more good-looking women at this show than I have in the previous 5 years.
And you know they weren't reading your magazine.
No.
No.
But they were good enough to come with their boyfriends. And I'm sure some of them play the games at home, because the one thing the game industry has done is has reached out to women to come up with games. And it tried for years, I mean, failing miserably, but kept trying. And they've obviously, if you look at the number of women who play games now, it's probably up to like 30%. And that's number in 1981 would have been inconceivable. I mean, I used to write comic books, okay? And I did better with women telling them I was a comic book writer than I did telling them I designed video games. So,
Tell you what, I saw the trend. It was like, must have been like 4 years ago when I moved to Phoenix. I went to a developer convention. I mean, like at Microsoft Development Convention. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, what a boring ass day this is going to be. Ain't no eye candy to look at, right? You get there and it's like, oh my God. There are women here.
Yeah.
And then you're like, going, wait a minute. There's not just women here.
They're cute.
Some of them are hot.
Yeah.
And you're going, wait a minute. Did I get the wrong hotel? So you're looking around going, this can't be the Microsoft Developer Conference.
Well, see, the CESs and E3s were always great because not only did the companies, all PR people were women in the industry at one point.
Absolutely. They're catering to the main demographic.
Exactly. They were, you know, they were there to meet and greet, and they were mostly, I mean, Atari had some of the sweetest women that I ever met in my life. You know, Activision had Diane Drosnes, who was a groundbreaker in the field. And, you know, that was nice. But better still, they brought in local models to do booth work, you know, to dress up as Lara Croft.
Yeah.
And I met this girl. She was at several shows 4 or 5 years in a row. And she played Barbie. And she was Barbie. I mean, she... And by the second year, I got to know her, you know. And, I mean, I would have gone to that show just to see Barbie. I mean, even if it hadn't been my job. So, you know, I'm used to going to shows where there are lots of eye candy around in that regard. So it's certainly nice to see it actually infiltrating the world of retro gaming.
Yeah.
Best booth babes ever.
Best.
It would be Return to Castle Wolfenstein, E3, like what, 3 years ago?
It's been 3 years now.
3 years ago, the Return to Castle Wolfenstein, you probably went.
Yeah.
The Return to Castle Wolfenstein booth was like wedged in this little tiny spot. You could not get to that booth because there was like a walkway from here to here. That was all the room there was, and it was packed. And they had like two girls there that were the booth babes. And it was like, damn.
They were popping out of the top.
It was just
back in the really old days. Back in the
But it's just like, it's amazing that, you know, that, like you said, I have seen, quote, civilians here.
Yes.
Not just girls working the booths that are brought because, you know. But they're actually, I mean, and look at the generation. There's a younger generation here today.
Very much so.
Last year it was like old balding guys like me.
Yeah.
Today, I mean, I see kids.
Yeah.
And the kids are sitting there playing freaking Demolition Derby. Yep. Look at them. Those kids are like 15
years old. They're discovering a whole new world. They're discovering games that were, you know, forged in the crucible of simplicity, of limitations, of not being able to do anything you wanted to do. You will limit, and that limitation can make you very bad or it can make you very good.
It's true.
Simplicity can often be the key to success.
Tell the CES story you were going to tell me before he interrupted you.
Oh, CES. Back, oh God,
bad,
I don't
Shane,
know.
Bad.
Not 1990 maybe. I don't know, maybe even earlier. Datasoft is still around. The big Apple software.
Old school.
They hired, you remember a guy named Captain Sticky? Remember a show called Real People?
Yes.
Okay, he was one of the regular cast. He was a guy, big fat guy. He looked like he was in a Knights of Columbus outfit with a red cape. And he declared himself a superhero named Captain Sticky. He had a sticky mobile. He had this big souped up car that was one day going to be fitted to fire marshmallows, okay? And he hired the stickettes. And he obviously cruised all the strip clubs in Chicago and found the best looking women. And there were like 15 of them packed in this tiny booth. And it was at the foot of an escalator. And Brodabun thought they had gotten this premier spot on the floor because they were right at the foot of the escalator. But DataSoft was over to the right of the escalator. So everybody, every guy coming down the escalator, head turned right as we go down, never even saw Rotorbun, turned right immediately and spent the rest of the day in the DataSoft booth.
Cool.
That's funny.
DataSoft or DataMost?
DataSoft.
I think it was DataSoft.
It was DataSoft.
Okay.
That's funny. Well, I know we have a 3:15 coming up, don't we?
Yeah.
I've got to have a break.
Yes.
Yeah, 3:15.
Even my voice is almost gone.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, and I like to talk, too.
You going to come over tomorrow, right?
Absolutely.
We'll have more Bill Kunkel tomorrow. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio at the Classic Gaming Expo 2003.
Bill Kunkel, Electronic Games Magazine, good friend of the Classic Gaming community as well as the gaming community in general. Please log on to our forums or just browse our forums to read wisdom from Bill Kunkel. In the spirit of keeping the content of the show short to make room for interviews, the Bits and Bytes section is going to be relatively short, but we got a couple of nice things here for you. First thing I want to talk about is the GameCube price drop. I thought this was kind of an interesting move by Nintendo, and it seemed freakishly desperate. And it's really not, doesn't take a lot of brain surgery here to figure out that, Nintendo's losing, and that's a very interesting thing to see happen in the console market. This could actually be attributed to several different possible factors, and we may never know exactly which one it is. Are gaming people just growing up? Are gaming people getting older? Like what some of the folks on our forum say, that there are more adults playing games and adults don't like to play kiddie games or be saddled with the Nintendo kiddie game image that is the GameCube perceived. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe the GameCube games just suck. Maybe that's the problem. I mean, I've only played a couple of them, folks, and, I can't jump for joy on this stuff. You know, one of their lead titles was basically a PC remake of Rogue Squadron, and Rogue Squadron, when you turned everything up, looked almost as good. That was like a six-year-old game when the GameCube came out. So I'm not exactly sure what strategy has failed in Nintendo's line. My recommendation to Nintendo would be, crap or get off the pot. You know, it's time to move the GameCube out of the kiddie look and feel. You know, get the handle off. Don't make it a Fisher-Price cube. Make an Extreme Edition, the GameCube Extreme. You know, make it look sleek and cool. Heck, steal frickin' Genesis's design. That still looks cool. Grab an old Genesis shell and shove a GameCube in there. You know, do something because you're hurting. And frankly, if it were me, you still own the handheld market. You're starting to get some competition in there. If the GP32 ever hits the shores over here, you could be screwed. So give it some thought, Nintendo. See what you can come up with. Because there's something rotten in Denmark, and here too, for that matters. And I'm not sure what it is, but Nintendo better figure it out. The $99 price drop is only going to take you so far. The people who are waiting or had an impulse buy to purchase a console will dry up before Christmas, and $99 ain't going to carry you through the holidays. Come up with something else. Get the wireless stuff out for the Game Boy Advance. You know, you don't have endless pockets. You got deep pockets, but not endless pockets like Microsoft. You got to do something. What else have I got this month? In addition to before I wrap up the GameCube stuff, I guess Midway's Treasures is out for like $20 on the GameCube new. That sounds like a good deal to me. It has all the cool games that the other collection packs have. So if you're a GameCube owner, you just bought that $99 GameCube, that might be a great way to get things started. We did run across a cool little goodie. I'll give you a link. It's called, I think it's called Free Run. For some reason, I don't have the... Oh, it's Run Out. That's what it is. Run Out is a free OpenGL-based OutRun clone. And I'll tell you what, it's pretty cool. It's a little rough around the edges. But if you're an OutRun freak like the rest of us are, and you want to see 3D technology used for something useful, check out Run Out. I also want to give you a quick, not a full review, but a very quick mini review of the Namco 5-in-1 Arcade Games Collection. Now, I'll be honest with you, what people have been saying about it are true. These aren't the real arcade games. And I'm not even exactly sure what games they are, because I've compared them against all the major versions of the other games, like Pac-Man, I guess I could tell you what's in it. The unit is just like all the other X and 1 games. You know, the 10 and 1 Intellivision and 10 and 1 Atari. They're all basically a self-contained handheld, which you throw some batteries in it, you plug it directly into the auxiliary jacks on your TV. No cartridges, no consoles, no power supply. You plug it in, you turn it on, and you're playing games. Cool idea. And if it was perfect, it would be, well, perfect. But unfortunately, the implementation of it's not quite there yet. And whatever they're doing, they're probably doing it to sneak around licensing or copyrights or something. Or just to scale it into the hardware that's in the box. None of these are exactly right. Even the Atari one that we looked at, I think, last year, while the games looked pretty close, the sound was off. And I say off as in the sound effects aren't quite right. Now, the Namco 5-in-1, the first time I played it was with no sound. I didn't have the sound rigged up right, and I was just playing it through the video. And at first, I was quite impressed. The games looked very, very close, but not quite right, but close. I mean, close enough to where you really wouldn't bitch about it. But then when I turned the sound on, I realized that these are not even close to the original games. Now, if you're a passing fad, if you just have a passing fancy for Pac-Man, you know, and you didn't, you know, grow up being spoon-fed Pac-Man cereal, then this is probably okay for you. You can pick it up for about $18.99 at Walmart. And I'll tell you, what they did get right this time was the four-way controller. The controller's like a big, well, not big, but it's a good size, it looks like a little piece of an arcade controller that has a four-way joystick in it. And a couple of, you know, reset buttons and stuff like that. And I'll tell you, it feels good. I mean, it feels really good. It's the best feeling one of the group. If nothing else, it's nice to have a four-way Pac-Man. But what's not nice is a four-way Bosconian. There's Dig Dug in there. There is Bosconian. I think Rally X is in there. And Pac-Man, of course. I'll tell you what, folks. The games are serviceable. In other words, if you're on a trip and you got to have a buzz, this will get you by. If you're a purist, like most of us are, you're going to go, damn it, I've been taken again, I bought the same games again, and they're still not right. MAME even emulates them better, which you would hope so. But I don't know, Pac-Man's kind of slid out. You shouldn't need a gigahertz machine to run Pac-Man. Anyway, so the bottom line on the 5-in-1 thing, folks, as a collector, of course you have to have one. You might leave it in the box, though. There's not a lot of play value in it. But as a collector value, it's gonna make you some cash because it's got Pac-Man splashed all over it. Honestly, though, you know, if you're happy with whatever implementation you're playing these games on now, you might want to pass on this one. That's just my thought. Lastly, I'm going to send you a link, and I'm hoping that the news article is still live by the time the show comes out. You may not remember it. But ages ago, when the Apple II GS came out, they were sued by, I believe it was Capitol Records back then. It was the label that carried all the Beatles songs. I think it was Capitol. You know, on the LP, if you guys remember back that far, it had a half-open apple on the front of it, right? I think that was Capitol Records, but it's eluding me right now. But anyway, remember how the Apple II GS just vanished? I mean, it was there one day, the next day it was just gone. And a lot of people don't know what happened. Well, Capitol Records slant the Beatles sued Apple because they were using the Apple logo in a multimedia environment. In other words, the Apple II GS, the GS stood for graphics and sound. they looked at the Apple II GS as a musical instrument, which they believed infringed on their copyright of the Apple in the music industry, right? Because that was the Capitol Records logo, was the Apple, right? So they sued Apple, and Apple just up and quit making 2GSs right on the spot. I guess apparently, now this is just a guess, and I bet the game doctor out there can tell us the real story, but apparently in the early days, Capitol Records and Apple had a fight over the actual use of an Apple in their logo. And they basically settled it out of court, and Capitol Records said, you know, as long as you don't make a musical instrument, right, as long as you don't try to use the Apple logo in a competing way, we have no problem with it, right? Capitol Records had it first. Well, Apple agreed, and hence came this whole Apple suit. Well, apparently, the Beatles are back after Apple. What for this time? iTunes. That's right. Now Apple is treading once again into the music industry's field, and Beatles slash Capitol Records, whomever, they don't like it. They don't like it at all. And they brought a lawsuit against them, and I'll try to give you that link. I thought that was a very interesting circle that has come from way back and made a full circle back again. It's funny how stuff like this just never dies, isn't it? Well, folks, I think I'm going to wrap this up for Bits and Bytes. I don't want to start rambling here. I could just talk all day about the Beatles and Apple, but we have a lot more show to worry about here, so we're going to wrap it up, and we'll see you next month on Bits and Bytes. We welcome Howard Scott Warshaw back to the show for part two of his interview from the Classic Gaming Expo 2003. Howard Scott Warshaw, of course, was the mastermind behind the 2600 games. Well, where do you want to start? Yar's Revenge, of course, E.T., but I don't know if we could really call that a mastermind thing, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So let's just listen to the man who sounds like Norm MacDonald. Ready, go.
So I did want to ask you, what is your relationship with Nolan Bushnell like now?
Right now?
Well,
we're not seeing each other technically.
We just get together on the weekends for a movie.
You
and
mean just a booty call, right?
You know how it is.
I mean,
I just saw him out in the hallway. That's the first time I saw him since I interviewed him for the Once Upon Atari stuff.
Okay.
So, you know, lately I haven't seen too much of him. He's been on the run a lot. But he's there. He's cool. He's starting You Wink now. That's his latest endeavor, so we'll see where that goes.
Do you, I mean, as far as, does he get along with, do the former Atari employees still get along with him?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's got, you know, no problems with anybody. And, you know, most of the bad stuff that went down at Atari went down after he left.
Oh, okay.
Right, so no one, most people from Atari, if they had anything to do with Nolan, have nothing but good feelings for Nolan.
Okay. Nolan's a good dude. Is he still like the daddy kind of?
Yeah, he was just the right dude. You know, I mean, he was cool. He was clean. He was there. You know, he understood what it was like to really pound away on the games and work on it. He had a good attitude, you know, from a developer's point of view. So everybody was cool with Nolan. Like I said, you know, he wasn't part of any of the corporate crap that came down. Now, had he stayed at Atari when Atari became really intense, really large and stuff, I don't know. I don't know what would have happened. But the fact is, you know, it was Warner was there when the thing took off, and Warner were the ones that brought, you know, all the pressure, all the heat and stuff, and a lot of the money. You know, because there wasn't a lot of big money there when Nolan was there either. So people were good with Nolan. No animosity there.
Well, I would like to cover today. Would like you to plug the hell out of your CD, because I went to your website, and after I read the website, I was like, I need a CD. I need it. I got to have it.
It's on his arm and stuff.
Yeah.
The DVD.
The DVD, I'm sorry.
No, it's my fault entirely. I should have made it on a CD.
Nah.
Yeah, the DVD's cool, yeah. I mean, this is just the work that I collected over years with going back. I read some of the articles on Atari, and it really kind of bugged me because it was all crap, for one thing. Two, it didn't cover anything of the interesting. It was like they were trying to write interesting articles about Atari that didn't have the background for it and didn't know what went on there.
Yeah.
And they wrote things that really weren't that interesting, I thought. But also, I couldn't believe the stuff they missed because there was such intense stuff that was going on there. So I decided to just go and become a producer myself and put together something because I knew it was an amazing story. You didn't have to exaggerate or lie about it to make an amazing story out of it. So I went and interviewed the people, and like other people have interviewed these same programmers, but they didn't know what to ask because they don't know the crap that these people used to pull.
Right.
And also, those programmers aren't necessarily going to be comfortable talking to somebody else about some of the more intense stuff that we used to do.
Right.
Whereas I can just sit there and ask the point blank, hey, you know, Jim, remember when you did that thing in the hot tub? Remember this stuff? Remember when we spilled the Coke? You know, everybody's down on the floor with the straws and stuff. You know, other interviewers aren't going to know to ask that, and they're not going to be comfortable answering that with other reporters. But when I was there doing it, you know, with them, it's just they're reminiscing and they forget about the camera, and it's great.
And we do a lot of that here.
I will say that's how our interviews.
Yeah, so you know how it is. The people you're hooked up with, you know, you get better material out of them.
Absolutely.
Like even with you yesterday we were just talking, and do you realize the stuff that you were saying to us?
I'm a natural.
But I mean,
you know, I can't help it. You guys are too good. You just draw it out of me.
That's what everybody has been saying about us.
Well, there you go.
You say stuff.
So next year when we need somebody to. I spoke to somebody to say, you know, Say something good about Retro Gaming Radio. You'll be able to say they're evil, they suck stuff out like a vampire, and you're willing to give the blood.
Retro Gaming sucked the juice out of me. They got it going.
Damn. You got definitely putting that for the year five promo.
Yeah.
Too funny. So, basically, this DVD is storytelling.
Oh, the DVD is a narrative, and it's, you know, I have a weird documentary style that's like a lot of work for me, but I think it works. And that my style with documentaries, I only let people who were firsthand involved in the experience talk. I don't believe in using a narrator to tell you what their point of view is and then throw in a clip here and there.
Right.
So what you hear is almost, you don't hear anyone who was not directly working on the VCS at Atari in those days. And the little narration there is me. I'm the only one who's in any capacity as a narrator. But mostly it's just they're all the quotes of the people strung together into what I think is a fairly clean narrative. And it tells some unbelievable stories. And people just lay it out. You know, they just lay out the truth about what we did. And it was unbelievable what we did. You know, at Atari, we had our own building. And Atari security had orders to keep the police away.
Wow.
And we knew that. So it was like we did anything we wanted to do. And we knew. We were insulated. We were protected. No one was going to come after us or screw with us or anything. So it's like we took advantage of that. No question about it. And that's what Once Upon Atari, that's the main thrust of it. It's like talking about the shit we did to take advantage of that fact. You know, the stuff that just, the outrageous stuff that we did. There was the animosity between us and marketing and management because people knew we were doing this stuff. Some people were jealous of it. You know, some people were bitter about it. Some people didn't like it, and so they got into the scene, and there was some ugliness there, and a lot of the infighting that went on. There's also some of the good stuff, you know, there's some of the really amazing fun times we used to have. There's also the game design. I cover game design and game designers and the 2600 specific stuff, and episode 3, which I just finished recently, has all the stories I held back from earlier episodes because I was like a little afraid, but the statute of limitations has run. So as far as I'm concerned, it's open territory, and so there's some pretty intense stories coming through in this episode that I just finished. So,
are there any myths that you'd like to dispel about Atari?
Yeah, there's got to be good myths that you've heard.
Well, the myths I'd like to dispel would be that there was just a clean, wholesome environment behind the scenes, and there was just these nice little guys programming games. What a den of iniquity.
Well, you know what? I think I heard that at first as you guys were existing, but long afterwards, I started hearing the stories about...
Yeah, it's come out better.
Like I said, me and him were like, we heard the smoking the reefer stories and doing all the
show
drugs.
Us the reefer stories.
Yeah, and...
You know. The MRBs, that's in the DVD. MRBs, marijuana review boards. We used to announce that over the intercom.
Oh my God!
We'd go, "There's MRB in such and such an office." You know, MRB, 2:00. You know, in Howard's office.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then everybody knew the people who were in the on the committee. They knew where to show up for the next meet.
Wow. Well,
and that was sweet. That's not a myth. That's reality.
Do we get historical footage on the DVD?
You get some. You get game
footage. Obviously, there wasn't
a lot of game footage.
Right.
Yeah, and also, you know, you got to be careful with that footage because of rights and stuff
like that.
Yeah. So I wanted to keep this Once Upon Atari clean. You know, so there's no... Well,
all the drugs are still clean.
Yeah, I wanted to keep the production clean, let's put it that way.
Okay.
But the details, they're ugly in the extreme. There's no question about it. And, yeah, so the old footage, you can have tricky stuff with the rights. So there isn't much footage anyway, and what there is, I tended to shy away from just because it's a mess. But what I do have is I have photos of the day, and so you'll see people, what they look like then, and you see them now.
You guys see like weird old freaky prototype crap thrown together, stuff like that?
You guys look so much different. I mean, to the point to where I didn't know who to look for when I was looking for you. I'm like... I have no clue where to begin to figure out what do you look like.
Well, I'm just healing up from all the plastic surgeries. You know, it ain't easy.
But,
I mean, people change. Now, this is a long time. I mean, you know, we were together at Atari, you know, 20 to 25 years ago.
Right.
That's a long time. And then it's been a while since I shot the interviews, too. The interviews were shot about 5-6 years ago.
Wow.
And but now it's all together. The whole thing's done. One solid DVD volume. And it's smoking. It's just...
Are there any nice Easter eggs with some nasty revealing footage or anything on there?
There's...
I'll tell you there was no Easter egg on the DVD.
No, there is one signature that no one has found.
Really?
I have a signature. I'll tell you, it's in episode 2. There is one place in episode 2 where you can find an HSW. And I have advertised that for years and told people since I first produced that episode. No one has found it yet. No one has identified properly the HSW that I planted in episode 2. And it's right there. I mean, you can't miss it. And then there's a few other little surprises here and there on the DVD. There's also even some of the warning messages and stuff.
I love the warning messages at the beginning. That was great. Prenatal.
Yeah. It contains graphics, language, and adult simulations. You know,
yeah, I like that.
That is certainly true. And, yeah, so I put a little you know, little clever things, little cute things here and there because that's what I do. You know, I always sign my work.
Yeah, I'd have been disappointed if the DVD didn't have something funky in there like that.
So it's got a little funkiness, but it's got a lot of just intense stories. The Monterey brainstorming session story about when Todd jumped off the balcony of the fifth floor. That was sweet.
Way too much reefer.
A little booze involved in that also. That was a drinking and smoking night. That was one of the bigger ones.
That's a bonus
and,
night.
Yeah, we had... You know, you never knew what was around the corner at Atari. It was always something weird and wild. You got Heather with his hot tub stories. You know, this guy was a babe magnet. I mean, I never saw anything like this, ever. I mean, me and Polaro and Heather would go, you know, after work sometimes we'd go out for a couple of drinks, get some nachos or something, sitting in a bar. And every time we would go there with Heather, we never left with Heather. Heather always left with some other chick.
That's amazing.
Unbelievable. I mean, and he didn't do anything. He'd sit down with us. We'd just be talking. And women would come up to him. Women would come up to him with notes from other women.
Damn.
You know, say, you know, my friend thinks you're so cute here. Read this. You know, we want you to come have a drink with us. And it's just unbelievable.
Insane.
Then he hooked up with this chick named Lorraine, who was a really good-looking woman also. And not that Heather was a good-looking woman. But and the funny thing was, it'd be weird. You know, you go to a bar with the two of them. And they would sort of split up a little bit, and all the chicks would sort of gather around Jim, and all the guys would sort of gather around Lorraine. It was just unbelievable. You know, it was like
wow.
They were an amazing couple.
So, did coding classic video games get you laid? I mean, could you go up and say, I did Yards of Vengeance, let's go?
No.
No.
Could you
not
say,
really.
Could you say, I work for Atari, let's go.
In some circles, you know, sometimes you can say, I work for Atari, I got some code. And then there might be...
They'll hear Atari, they hear Coke.
Oh, what?
I have what? Coke.
Yeah, what, no Pepsi? I want a 7-Up. Yeah, I know. I hear you.
That's
but, you know, there was some of that. There wasn't much. Inside Atari, there was some of that.
Really?
It was like, yeah, you know, oh, you did this, so you guys are getting royalties, aren't you? Yeah.
Oh, gold diggers.
Yeah, gold diggers within the company.
You see some of that stuff going
That's
on.
Harsh.
But
harsh.
Mostly it wasn't a on-time thing, you know, all over the place. You know, and outside, people thought it was cool when you worked for Atari, but they didn't automatically change their posture.
Another Atari myth, the naming of the prototypes, the code names like Stella.
Oh, yeah. Those were all chicks inside Atari.
Can you tell me about those chicks?
They were mostly administrative assistants. Oh, yeah. They were all real chicks.
Were they getting banged?
There was Stella and Colleen. Were they getting banged?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Was it more or less like, hey, if you know...
I banged this chick, so I'm going to name the next prototype after.
If you sleep with me, I'll name the prototype after.
No, I don't think that was the deal, but I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you a story that I probably shouldn't tell you, but I heard the story. Now, this, I don't know about this. It's a total rumor.
Oh, this
but
is a heard, complete plausible deniability.
Yeah, no, I heard the story once that Nolan himself got caught on the assembly line.
Damn!
With some chick.
If we get him, we need to ask him about that.
Now, we're not getting Nolan.
Good.
They said Nolan's not doing any interviews.
Oh, well.
Yeah, but that was a hearsay story. I mean, that's just, I heard it from some guy.
So is that the chick that is now the prototype?
That
of
was not Stella, as far as I know. No, Stella, I think, was a chick who worked in
Summer
Engineering.
Does she know that the 2600 was named after
she
her?
She must. She must. I can't believe that she didn't know about it, because everyone was talking, Stella this, Stella that, Stella
question
this.
Question is, did she get royalties?
No, I don't think so.
No royalties for you.
Nobody got royalties on the base unit. That I know. But it's, yeah.
Somebody somewhere, while you guys were doing your gig, somebody must have came up with some clever, freaky crap to plug into the Atari. I mean, obviously somebody tried to put a keyboard in there, so that's weird and wild enough, but...
Oh, the mind control, the mind control device.
The mind control stuff, they wanted to do that. That wasn't really mind control, but that was the... it was going to measure your head tension.
Right.
And stuff. Yeah, they wanted to do stuff with that. It was like they were sort of... We had these guys from a psychic institute.
Oh, God.
And they were trying to do this thing of, like, you know, mind control on the games and using, you know, like, telepathy for controllers. But it was really just measuring muscle tension in the head. So that didn't really go anywhere. There was a light gun. Dave Stogas programmed the light gun.
Right.
There was a thing they had. People had the... what do you call
it? Wireless joysticks that were humongous and
things ridiculous. That hot-wired the thing. They had superchargers, you know.
That's right.
They had things that had more RAM. They had parts that had an additional 128 bytes of RAM. 128 bytes. 128 bytes of RAM.
That doesn't seem
gross.
Right.
Doesn't seem much. But then, but you get another 128 and it doubled it.
Yeah.
Doubled your RAM, which is pathetic, you know, to think that 128 bytes, that you'd be excited about getting another 128 bytes.
Was that a big deal to you when you saw that?
Yeah, it was huge. It doubled our RAM, you know. It was like twice as much we used to have.
You were actually able to put... speaking of text, what was the guy smoking who made the basic programming cartridge?
Yeah.
Do you know who that guy was?
The basic programming cartridge, you know, a lot of people thought was very cool, you know. It was your first chance to program, you know. Forget saving a program.
Or running the program.
Well, I mean, yeah, how many bytes did you have free to work with? I mean... After the tokenizer and everything else.
Well, you still only got 128 bytes of RAM.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, 10 print out of memory. Damn it. Better use smaller line numbers or smaller tokenized commands.
That stuff went much better with the 800 computer.
Oh, of course. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, but the stuff, you know, like I learned to program on the 2600 was... Yeah. Nobody wrote any major programs with that thing.
But yet you guys managed to squeak
didn't
some
develop
amazing
a lot of
crap
software.
Out.
That wasn't our host system for developing 2600 games.
Sure it wasn't.
Promise you that.
E.T. wasn't written on that?
Nah. E.T. written in Atari 2600 Basic.
E.T. wasn't written on anything it hadn't been erased from so far, I think. So that's...
Damn.
Yeah, try and find that bad boy.
Why... Was there any testing done at all on E.T. to know that about the falling in the hole problem?
Oh, no, there wasn't really any play test. I mean, we knew there was an issue with that, but it just wasn't time. I mean, what are you going to do?
There wasn't even enough time just to get rid of that problem?
No, 5 weeks is, you know, it's not much time. So it was the basic game. I put in a few things to try and account for it, but no, and I should have just made a thing like when you get out of the well, you're automatically set some safe place. You know, it's always easy in retrospect, babe. You know, when you're pounding on it like 24 hours a day going through and you see, got to get it done, got to get it done, got to get it done, got to get it done.
So do you think technically you released a beta? ET technically
Oh, yeah.
Beta?
I mean, in the normal flow of gaming, you know, my advice is take at least 7 weeks to make a game.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like,
at least seven.
You know, the 5 weeks, it was too short. Yeah, so it was basically a beta version because that was... I got that game in 5 weeks to the point where most people would have a game after about 3 months and they would expect to now start really examining the play and tweaking it out and doing something else with it. And that's where it was.
Do you think if you had more... I'm gonna ask you a stupid question, but I'm leading to something else. Do you think if you had more time, people wouldn't have been as pissed with E.T.? Or do you think people are pissed at E.T. because of the gameplay or because of the what the game ended up being, meaning...
Because of the shortcoming in time.
People were pissed at E.T. because their expectations were way blown out. See, the thing is, with Pac-Man, people were disappointed because they knew what they were expecting.
Right.
And they didn't get it.
That wasn't it.
Okay. With E.T., they didn't know what they were expecting, right? But they were expecting something really cool.
And that wasn't it.
And I guess, you know, this definitely was not it. Now, with a little more time, would people have been less pissed off? With a little more time, I would have cured some of the obvious problems with the game. Okay. So I figured that would make some people less irritated with the game. Would it have really been a super popular game at that point? I don't know. That's the big question.
Well, because the question I'm trying to ask is, it seems like it's not so much people are mad, hate E.T. because of the gameplay. It's more like... The story behind the this, like, what does this have to do with the movie? Would you have, if you had more time, would you have like 3 or 5 months into it gone, this doesn't look like what I thought it was going to look like. Let me try again. Let me scrap this whole thing. Or you had gotten a chance to play that
set
and gotten feedback and people has gone, this is not...
In terms of what the game looked like, I thought the look, you know, I mean, it was 2600, so you're not going photorealism or anything.
Right.
But, I mean, the look of the game, I didn't think there was any big problem with. I mean, basically, I mean, the things that were in it, the idea of a forest, you know, some federal buildings... And a lot of the wells. Well, the wells, where the fuck does that come from? I don't know.
Exactly. That's, you
know,
that's what I'm saying. But, like, after getting
why am I in a hole? You got to have a place to hide the phone pieces. And I had to do this fast. Now, I wasn't going to create 4 screens of unique worlds with all this stuff going on and still have places in it to hide stuff. That's, you know, I just didn't think of a way to do that easily. The thing about the wells was it's a quick solution. It's a fast thing to do. I can implement it. I can make it work. Takes you to another screen. There's a little play there, very little, you know, not much. And it's,
well, the reason why I'm asking you this, I'm just saying, I'm playing what if. Say, like, if you had gotten the project in a timely manner and had enough time, if you could go back in the time to, like, 19, to, like, at the beginning and say, you know what? If I write this, nobody will have a job in 2 years. And I can give you the... And you
but that's not E.T. I mean, that was never E.T. E.T. was not the thing that killed the whole situation. The thing that killed Atari was their practices in dealing with wholesalers, I think, over the years. That's the thing that killed Atari, because as soon as anyone got a chance to get back at Atari in any way, they jumped on them with both feet, because Atari had been screwing people right and left for a couple of years.
I know they had
so
been
that's
screwing
really
over
what
the
did it.
I know they had been screwing the... Arcade operators.
Oh, the home stuff was no different. When a hot game like Pac-Man would come up, they would tell wholesalers and retailers, okay, well, we'll give you 100 Pac-Man if you buy 100 Sun Cycle and 100 Combat.
Man.
They were using hotter games to clear out their old inventory and forcing people to buy stuff that they know isn't going to move.
That explains a lot.
And it's like stuff like that's cold.
Yeah,
that is cold.
And yeah, there were some ugly stories about that stuff. Stuff I heard that I won't even go into it.
Oh,
huh?
Is that on the DVD?
Yeah, some of that stuff is hinted at on the DVD. I mean, there's plenty of ugly stuff on the DVD, but the stuff that's ugly stuff on the DVD is stuff I saw, I heard, I firsthand. There was other stuff that's unbelievable that I just heard secondhand, thirdhand, and I don't want to go too far with that kind of stuff because, you know, it's just speculation. But unbelievable stuff, you know, I mean.
Give us one example.
Well, we know where Microsoft got the.
I'll tell you one thing that is on the DVD that hints at a lot of this stuff. You know, Warner, when they took over, there were some pretty high execs from Warner that used to come visit on a pretty regular basis. And when the head or, like, the second in command at Warner would come to visit, there'd be bomb threats.
Wow.
You know, now Atari never had bomb threats any other time. That was weird. But it's like sometimes these guys from Warner, like the really top guys from Warner, would show up in the building and there'd be bomb threats. Now, why is that? What's happening? What kind of dish these guys connected with?
Oh, yeah.
What are these guys into causing there to be bomb threats?
Because
it wasn't Atari that was the reason there was bomb threats.
Right.
Because these guys are getting bomb threats in a number of places they're going, I'm sure. And it was like, that was interesting. And if you draw the implications from that, you find some pretty hairy stuff going on in the international sales market and stuff like that. Pretty wacky stuff. Every once in a while, people would go on a sales trip and you'd never hear from them again.
Damn.
Now, maybe they got another job, you know? Maybe they took off for another company. Who
maybe,
knows?
Maybe they're buried with E.T. cartridges.
Yeah.
Buried with E.T. cartridges covering them. There you go. I don't know what's going on with that stuff, But believe me, I got the salacious stuff in this thing, because the stuff that we did by ourselves was like... Because this is by no means is supposed to cover every aspect of Atari all over the place. Because, you know, I've seen people try to do that, and it's just all mishmash, and nobody really gets anywhere. I took one thing that I knew about, and there was plenty of stuff to do, because the stuff that we did was outrageous. I mean, I just can't believe it, you know. No company would allow this to go on anymore. It will never happen again, because they just won't let it happen. But it was unbelievable. And that's why I had to make the documentary series in the first place. Because it was just a story that I just thought, you know, really people would want to hear if they had any idea what was going on with it. It was just so intense.
We were talking to one of the Intellivision guys about the rivalries between Atari and Intellivision. You know, what was it like for them being the upstarts with such a big hill to look up, you know? And I always wondered what the Atari slant was. I mean, did you guys ever even look at a television and go, woo, scary, you know?
No, we never really did. Because, you know, television was a better graphic system. There was no question about it. There was no debate about that. And at the same time, we had like 10 times the market share.
Yeah. So it's like they might have had the graphics, but you guys had the monopoly on all the rights for all the good games.
That's what he was saying. That basically, you guys had the licenses, and that kept them down.
Yeah. Well, that was the idea, I'm sure. You know, the part of all the Atari marketing and stuff. And you know, more power to them. You know, the thing is that, you know, for them, it was pretty intimidating. You know, they're looking up at Atari and they go, oh my God, you know, we're trying to claw our way in. And Atari's whole marketing strategy has nothing to do with making better games. It's right. All about just buying stuff up and trying to keep these guys in the cold. That's what it was all about. And that's what they could do because they had the money to do it for a while.
Everybody was screwing everybody.
Yeah. There was a whole lot of screwing going on back then.
Everything.
So, but how is Coleco able to get, you know, jump in and make a big, be a viable threat versus
Television. ColecoVision came along and just put the smack down. And that, I mean, everybody had a damn ColecoVision. I mean, was it timing for them?
They were a better price point, but they also were an earlier machine, I believe, weren't they? I mean, Coleco predated Television by a lot.
No,
they came out after.
I remember.
82.
It was. I think it was really close, though.
82?
82.
I thought it was close.
No, I remember them as being a lot earlier. But they came in, they took their shot, but the thing is they come in late just before the industry is going to die.
Their timing was bad.
I mean, everybody, by 82, everybody's jumping in with both feet. People are going crazy. The Magic's forming. You know, you've already had Activision going. And in 82, you've got everybody and their mother starting a VCS game, let alone other systems and things like that. And everybody knows the VCS is getting old. And that's why you see a ColecoVision and a Television. But the fact is, you know, people bought the VCS. That was the only really thorough market penetration system. ColecoVision sold some units and stuff, but I don't think anybody approached the 2600 numbers.
I was going to say, do you think if there was no video game crash that Coleco could have caught you guys and at least been a good number two threat?
Oh, if there wouldn't have been a crash and things would have gone on, Coleco could have been very viable. I mean, I don't know what Atari would have done, because 2600 was definitely coming to the end of its run. That wasn't going to keep going. And, you know, the 5200 didn't really seem to catch on.
I wonder why.
And the 7200...
Controller.
Yeah, the controller. And the 7200's got the same problem. Yeah. Plus, you know, it's got its own stuff going. They really couldn't get behind that at that point. You know, it was ripe for Nintendo to come in when they did and start, you know, a new market.
How did you feel when you heard that Atari said no to Nintendo as far as marketing their console?
You know, by that time...
You were really out of it?
It's all gone. Yeah, by that time, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, man. I've been pounding all night.
Was there anything going on when you were at Atari that you looked at and said, damn, that's really damn cool. Maybe I should, like, go hang with that. I mean, did you have any... I mean, I'm trying to think if even, like, Commodore 64,
Atari
the VIC-20...
That were going on?
No, like other companies, like computers. Did you ever think about jumping ship to computers?
Oh, man, I mean, we talk all about this in the DVD. There was a time where Todd and I were going to go form a company. There were two rounds of forming a company. There was one where we got courted by 20th Century Fox, I think it was. And we were on the verge of leaving. In fact, I wanted to leave. I told Todd, don't go tell anybody about this. But Todd ran right to George Kish, our boss, said, hey, you know, we got this other offer. You know, what are you going to do? But then 2 days later, Atari came down with $40,000 checks for us.
Wow.
And just handed them out. And that, I go through all that stuff in episode two. That's what that's all about, is the advent of the money and why it happened. The main reason, I mean, Activision formed and Atari said, you know, screw you. And a Magic formed and Atari said, well, screw us a little, but still screw you.
Yeah.
And then finally, like, Todd and me and a few other guys were contemplating leaving to go form something with 20th Century Fox, and they couldn't afford that. And they said, that's it. And that was the first time they came across with their own compensation package that really picked up.
Wow.
And that was it. That's when it happened. And literally, 2 days later, we got called into a conference room, and eight people got checks for $40,000.
Wow.
I was one of them. That didn't suck.
Bribe
cool
money.
Day.
Damn, that would have been a cool day.
Those were the best days of my life. Sitting there, have Ray Cazara, CEO, walk up to your hand, you big check. I told him, you know what I'm going to do with this money, Ray? He goes, what's that? I said, I'm going to start my own software company.
Damn.
He wasn't smiling, but I was kidding.
That's cool.
But then we did try to start our own company later on, you know, then, so that, we didn't do it that, but then about a year later, we were looking at actually starting a company ourselves. And that started to move along, but that's when the bottom fell out of everything.
And, but, you know, the PCs didn't, computers didn't die like the video
PCs
games did.
PCs weren't there yet. PCs
no.
weren't even there
I mean,
there
the 64
yet,
wasn't there at that time?
No, I mean, there was stuff like the Atari 400 and 800, but that's not really PCs. That's like the early kind of dicking around versions of PCs. You know, the IBM PCs, when things started to really disseminate, that was just, they were just coming on right when things had died. There were some games you get on them. I thought of writing games. I mean, I got a PC, and I started looking at assembly code on it. And I was looking at doing a few simple games and stuff on it. It just...
It didn't pull you, huh?
Nah, it didn't have the big draw for me. I needed to recover from Atari. Atari was a very, very intense experience. And right after Atari, like for the next year and a half, I needed to chill out and just really recover. Because, I mean, physically and mentally, it was just...
You had to have done something, though. You know, game programmers, the whores that we are, you don't go for a year without coding something. You got to be doing something.
Oh, like I said, I had a PC at home, and I'd be screwing around and coding some stuff here and there and playing with some simple things.
Got it.
But mostly I was just healing up, taking time, because it was a brutal, exhausting experience. Sorry. I mean, it's fun being at the center of a vortex, you know, but it's taxing. You know what I mean? I mean, it's taxing because you spend a lot of time worrying about a lot of intense things. You know, your average day at work, you're sitting there with $5 to $10 million worth of, you know, waiting on you.
Right.
You know, you got $5 to $10 million conservatively of a manufacturing backup, and all this stuff is waiting for you to do your thing and get it done. And, you know, you think about it, it grates on you because you're the only one.
You know, yeah, it's not like you can share the blame with somebody if something goes wrong.
Right, and that's it. You know that this thing sucks. Like, if you're going to turn out an ET, it's just you, babe. You know, people still, this is, you know, we're over 20 years later, and people still go, hey, ET sucks. Yeah, ET, I saw that, man. That was a piece of crap. You know, I still hear some of that. And some people go, oh, ET, yeah, that wasn't really as bad as everybody says. You know, that's the nice one. You know, so, you know, but that's cool, you know, because the fact is, hey, they're still talking about it. I know a lot of guys put out bad games and nobody mentions them anymore.
But
you know, if I fail, I fail all the way, baby.
Like I said before, I think the only reason why I do like E.T. is that I was able to finish it. And I think about if I couldn't have finished it, I'd probably be on the I hate E.T. bandwagon too. But I could finish it. It's like one of the few adventure games where the 2600 I can finish. So, I have no beef with you in the 18.
Yeah, no, the thing was supposed to be a, you know, get a little immediate gratification, because that's what gaming's
that's,
all about,
that's
right?
That's what I got out of it.
I mean, immediate gratification. This was like a game that had an adventure scope goal, but it was bite-sized enough, you know, that you could still do it. Like Raiders, you wouldn't want to sit down and just kind of knock Raiders out. Yeah, you know, you might as well shoot yourself in the head.
I never finished Raiders.
Yeah, Raiders
oh,
tough
did.
Game.
I did finish that.
I finished it once. When I did Raiders... And I had to go do a promotional thing, so we had to do a videotape array.
Oh, hell no, you had to play it all the way through?
So I had to play it wearing a microphone and narrate while I was
yeah.
playing. And I did it. It was one of the only times I played it. 12 minutes, I played the whole game perfect. Never made a slip. Went
wow.
right through the whole game, and even I'd never done that. But I don't know, they turned the camera on, they started recording the game, and I did the whole thing, flawless, one take, with narration. Then I took that tape to CES, showed it to Steven Spielberg. Okay, because he wanted to see this promotional tape we did of the game. We showed it, and at the end of the tape, he watched the whole tape through. At the end, he looks at it, and he goes, it's just like a movie. It's just like a movie. That made me feel so good. As
That's
Steven
cool.
Spielberg, look at this tape that I made, you know, and go, man, it's just like a movie.
Okay. Yeah.
That's success.
Cool. That was another good day. Yeah, Spielberg. I also had Spielberg on videotape calling me a genius. That's
wow.
cool.
That is cool. Cool. Was that like on a 1-inch master somewhere?
Yeah, actually, it's, you know, I had it on 3/4-inch beta, and I knocked it off. So I'm going to put it on my website. I've had that
yeah.
thing for years, and
oh,
I thought, you know,
yeah.
now I finally feel like putting it on.
Now, where are you going to get one of those, though? You have one still?
But he got, yeah.
Sell a player?
Oh, no, I have the tape, but I don't have the player for it. No, but I duped it off onto, like, SVHS
oh,
and stuff.
Okay.
I'm going to put it on my website. People can dupe it off all they want.
That's cool. Cool.
Anybody wants to take that thing and play it anywhere, go for it. It's just some interview I saw in 83. He did some interview, and he says, yeah, well, the E.T. thing, and we did a video game for it. He goes, hey, Atari, and I worked with this guy, Howard Warshaw, at Atari, and, you know, that guy is a certifiable genius.
Damn.
Like, yeah, I got Steven Spielberg on tape calling me a genius. You know, that and a buck still gets me a cup of coffee.
That's right. That's right. 15 seconds of fame.
That's it. I've used about 10 of them. The other five is going on Retro Gaming.
That's right. Retro Gaming. Do you still do any coding projects now?
I haven't done any actual coding in a couple of years. I've been managing programmers, game programmers, the last few years. I kind of enjoy that.
Don't you get the itch? I mean, I know that Atari, like, wore your ass out, but... I mean...
Okay, here's the thing. I get the itch to do creative product.
Thing. As long as you can get the creative edge out, it doesn't have to be in code.
Right, and that's the thing, because I'm not about coding. I'm about creative production.
Okay, now, I can understand
the
that.
The thing, making games back in the 2600, you had to code to do your creative work.
Right.
So I did. You know, I learned to code to be creative. I didn't learn to be creative by coding.
Gotcha.
Right?
That's the thing, and that's me.
That's what I'm about. So I'll go learn anything I need to do to be creative in a medium I want to be creative in. So I made the DVD. So first I went to school, and went to University of California, and they had like an 18-month course in video production. So I finished that thing in 9 months and got my final project aired on PBS. Because that's the kind of guy I am. You know, it's like I want to learn video production because I wanted to do Once Upon a Time. So I said, okay, I'm going to go learn to do that because here's the creative thing I want to do. What do I need to do that? Back in the day, you know, I said, okay, I'd like to make games. I think that'd be cool. That'd be creative. So I went and learned what I needed to know to make games. And I showed up, and I convinced them I knew it, made them hire me, and bam, and then I made some games. And that's it. So I did the video, and then it was like, okay, well, people want it on DVD. And I thought, yeah, DVD's sweet. So I went out, and I learned what I needed to know to do some DVD authoring and mastering. And, you know, and you guys have seen the thing. You know, it's like, I think it's a decent, you know, DVD authoring presentation in addition to the video production that's behind it. So, and that's it. Whatever the next thing is, you know, if it's wireless communication or, you know, phone gaming or whatever it is, then I'll jump into that and I'll learn what I need to know quickly. And that's it, because I have to be doing something creative. And the fact is that working in games lately, I enjoy managing and I like the things that that requires. And, you know, I'm, you know, just puffed up enough, essentially, you know, to be able to manage programmers well and keep them stimulated and keep them working effectively.
Right.
But that doesn't do it for me creatively. So
no.
When I got a thing going on like that, I also have to have some other side project, and that's what I do. So I've done documentaries, I've written books, done a lot of photography, all kinds of videography. I just do that to keep myself creatively productive, because I have to be turning out a creative product, whatever it is. Something that people are going to look at, and they're going to laugh, they're going to cry, they're going to be entertained, whatever it is, they're going to have some kind of emotional reaction because of something I did. And that's what I'm about. You know, that's Howard Scott Warshaw.
Yeah. Let me see if you got anything to fill in with.
That's it.
I'm running out of stuff.
I'm done too.
I'm good.
Cool.
Okay.
We already got a closing from the other one, so
yeah,
we're good with that.
Sweet.
We'd like to thank Howard Scott Warshaw for his very long, in-depth, and very interesting interview at the Classic Gaming Expo 2003. Don't forget to look for his DVD, Once Upon Atari, which features tons and tons of cool behind-the-scenes secret stuff about Atari that you probably didn't know and probably didn't want to know. But grab that at the site. We'll give you the link on the left, as per always. Thanks again, Howard Scott Warshaw.
It's time for an 8-bit flashback.
All right, for this flashback, we're going to look at the title Mega Man from Capcom on the Nintendo Entertainment System. This is one of those ones that we get written all the time, over and over again. Mega Man. You know, you talk about Mega Man. It's one of those ones you just get tired of hearing about, and the fact that they spawned like 27 sequels to the game doesn't exactly help. But we're going to give it a fair go. This is Shane R. Monroe, of course, behind the microphone with Brian Smith in front of the keyboard with the Nintendo emulator. And go ahead, Brian. Okay. Why don't you get started over there?
Mega Man's another game that I like. What makes Mega Man cool is that you can pick the different stages. What happens is that, well, and what you don't learn until after you play the game and beat the first stage for the first time is that you gain the boss character's special abilities. Like Cut Man has like a little scissors thingies. Iceman has, I guess, ice. I always sucked at Mega Man. I think I've only beaten Cut Man. I don't think I've ever gotten really any further than this guy.
Okay, we have Cut Man here.
He looks like he has a Pac-Man on top of his head.
We get 90,000 for killing him off. Okay. The character animation's actually a lot better. We looked at Castlevania earlier today. The character animation's a lot better. It looks like we have maybe a health bar there on the left. For those of you who have not played Mega Man or know what we're seeing here, we're talking a standard horizontal scroller. It doesn't look like we're going to do any vertical scrolling here, maybe later, but not right now.
Because Brian's getting his ass kicked.
Brian is getting his ass obliterated. We got these little freaky-ass smiling whirly-whirl guys.
Oh, yeah, I forgot those things hurt you.
I do definitely like the character animation. He blinks.
A lot.
Ah! I like it a lot.
There you go. You can shoot those things.
Oh, see, now you should have landed on that platform.
Why?
I don't know. That's what makes sense.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, we are... Okay, we're not... Okay, yeah, we're going up and down here. We got these things shooting... Brian goes right back down to the bottom level.
Ah.
All right, back to the bottom. This will be an effort in futility here, folks.
There you go. Damn, they're bombing me, dude. See?
There you go. These guys seem to shoot laterally, so that seems to make it a little more of a pain in the butt.
This is why I sucked at Mega Man. Oh, yeah, you gotta wait until the thing...
You know, it's easier if you don't jump into their bullets.
Thank you.
I just can't wait till I get in front of this. I'll be getting my ass beat. Brian will be able to give me a bunch of crap. The tile sets are considerably less inventive than Castlevania. What was the copyright on this? You remember?
No.
Oh, you just died anyway.
Yeah, that's what sucks about Mega Man. It starts you all the way from the freaking beginning.
Yeah, there could have used to have been some checkpoint action in there. And you get the same enemies, too. Now, what's that little ball do for you?
I think that replenishes my energy.
A little health? Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Which disappeared.
I don't even know if I need to, I don't know if I need to bother trying this thing. I'm going to get my butt kicked. Yeah, I definitely like the tile sets. It's funny. I was just bitching about the tile sets a little bit on Castlevania, but when you look at Mega Man, the tile sets on Castlevania look like graphic art.
Dang.
But you know what? It's not the graphics that make the game, okay? I'm just commenting because I need to talk about something while Brian's playing. And he's playing the same parts over and over again, so I got to come up with something new.
That's not my fault.
I do say I don't care for the music. It's part of that irritating Nintendo generation music. There are some good Nintendo music pieces, don't get me wrong.
They are?
Yeah, I've heard some.
Super Mario Brothers thing?
Yeah, this isn't going as well as it could be. I'd comment on some new stuff to see, but... Yeah, it's nice to see even back then that they were working on character animations and stuff. Of course, Prince of Persia, I think, defined.
Man,
he's got to go all the way back to the bottom. Now, see, that's something that always bothered me about some games is when they regenerate the enemies. I mean, if they start you over again, that'd be fine, but when you fall down...
Don't recreate the enemies.
Don't recreate the enemies. That's
kind
of a downer.
If you kill them, they're dead.
Yeah. Hey, this is farther than you made it before. I suppose you can duck, can you?
No.
No ducking. Yeah, kind of slow here. Brian's trying to get through a tenacious little area. At least you didn't go all the way down to the bottom. Looks like you have a little control when you fall. That looks like it's already been useful. Well, I don't know what that is, but you want that. Okay, we're at the top. We're
this
in a box.
The box.
Oh, we got some scissor things coming out. Oh, Brian!
If this thing
starts
from the beginning, I'm gonna be pissed.
It's gonna start.
This is why I don't play Mega Man.
Screwed.
This is why I don't play Mega Man.
Now, see, you know what? if that happened to me, I don't know if I'd pick the game up again. There's a certain amount of leeway you give video games that there's a point to putting you back a certain amount, or you go to a checkpoint and it's part of the game parameters. Putting somebody back from the beginning to the beginning of the level from the very end of the level,
that's booty. That's what we call booty.
Call getting booty.
No, not getting booty. Sucking booty.
Sucking the booty. Yeah, Brian's almost dead again.
I don't even care anymore.
That's not a good sign. Okay, it's time for Shane to get behind and give it a whirl.
Just stop.
Okay, go ahead.
Testing. Okay. All right, we're back with Shane in front of the keyboard. We're getting ready to go in to do a little Mega Man action. I, too, will play Cutman because that would only be fair. And today, Cutman will be worth $100,000. Well, very good. All righty then. Let's see. You can fire on the ladder. Now, see, that's something that you don't see in a lot of games. Being able to fire on the ladder.
James, not doing too bad. Okay, I lied.
Yeah, I've got caught down here. Whoop! See, now that's gay.
What'd you press?
Goddamn Windows keys right under here. All right. You know what? That pisses me off. I hate the Windows key. Now I gotta start this crap all over again. Where'd you start? You can just edit all this crap out.
Yeah.
Now watch, I'm gonna get like, fuck that's dick. Not like I'm gonna beat him anyway. Okay. It's interesting, you can't get up there. Okay. Gotta get a rhythm for getting those guys. Of note here, folks, the longer you hold the jump key down, the longer you jump. The higher you jump, I should say. That tends to make things a little easier. Dun, 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 dun. As annoying as it is, the song's kind of catchy. I'll probably be singing it in my sleep later.
We'll be editing He's My Guy later on tonight.
Nice.
Fix that problem right now.
Thanks, yeah, that'll take care of that. If I can't get that song out of my head, it's all over with.
You got more help than I had.
Oops.
Now you're doing what I did.
Yeah, see if I can recover a little quicker here. This is a lot of the standard jumping and precision timing and shooting. You see a lot of this. Nothing at all wrong with it.
Yeah, just go. Okay, yeah. Now you're at the boss. No, not yet.
What are these right. things? Okay.
Things you need to shoot.
Things to shoot that come after you, like that. These are like little, I don't know what you'd call these. But you know what? Oh, you know where? Guess where I'm going to have to go.
Yeah, back to the beginning.
See, this is just isn't right, folks. I don't like going back to the complete beginning. This helps define the generation of frustrating platformers. You know, in this game, it seems that some of the best answers are running instead of fighting.
Yeah, I was going to tell you that. Run. Run, Forrest!
Run, Forrest, run! These little smiley guys just whooping my ass. Star Wars style, I can't shake him.
And there's no R2 to increase the power.
Alright. Now that I have absolutely no health to continue with, All right, well, we might recover. I have, like, no health. I believe the word here is screwed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're dead here.
Oh, and I missed the...
Whee!
Whee, I get to go back down, yay! Back up, back down, back up, back down. Seeing the enemies...
You're doing what I did last game.
I love dropping back and forth like this, yeah.
Ow.
That was unpleasant. Yeah, what? How come I didn't get any health?
I don't know which one to give you health.
It does look like these guys firing a pattern, actually. Alright, see, that didn't give me health at all for that.
No.
That sucks.
Those red balls are not health. You're dead, Jim.
That's it. Pause it. Alright. Let's take the final man out for a spin. The buttons are wrong for me. The jump and the fire button seem backwards. I wonder what those little balls are for.
Never mind.
Oh. Okay, let's see if we can make some headway here. Boy, this looks familiar. I'm not a big fan of
Deja Vu.
The shots that they purposefully put in to piss you off. It's not like it's a skill game. It's a matter of getting past each individual little spot that sucks. Oh, that was health. Little white thing. It seems like the game really isn't a matter of playing. It's a matter of getting past each part that sucks. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
That's what Mega Man is to you, huh?
So far. They do fire in a nice sequence that you can pick up on. So that's good. Those little things on the walls. All right. I'll take care of that. Oops. Okay, well, let's take a little final peek here at Mega Man. That was from Capcom, of course. Brian, opinions?
Yeah, I don't like the idea that when you die, you go all the way back to the beginning. That's why I think I stopped playing the game. I have gotten past, like I said, I've only gotten past Cutman like a couple of times, but I've never... This is another game I haven't finished, but I really enjoyed playing when I used to play. A buttload of dang, I can't stop coughing. And I used to play a buttload of Nintendo games. What's this scratcher for?
What?
I thought you were gonna
start beating you with it?
Yeah.
That is cool, like wicker back scratcher.
It came from Hawaii.
I was just starting to, I was fidgeting with it, and Brian's looking at me like I'm gonna start beating him.
Because I was coughing.
Yeah. Stop coughing, damn it.
But that's... Now I remember why I didn't play it. I don't play it anymore.
Now, what about the other ones? Are they the same sort of deal? Did they improve any of that, or do you remember?
To be honest with you, I never got into any of the other ones. Uh-uh.
This is another one of those game series that just kind of went on and on, right? They made those. They made Mega Man just about everything.
You can play Mega Man on the Super Nintendo, PlayStation... I think you can play on the PlayStation 2.
Yeah, I think they have one coming out for GameCube, right?
I don't know. Not to my knowledge.
I don't know.
Capcom's making games for Nintendo now?
Dude, who knows?
But the cool thing is that these were games made before Capcom became known as the Street Fighter people. So this is kind of towards the end of their originality phase of the company.
And this too is 1987, same as Castlevania. So
this is first generation also.
First gen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it definitely when we looked at Castlevania earlier this evening, it definitely shows off that Castlevania was definitely ahead of its time, because the Mega Man graphics, while, you know, utilitarian and working, and the guy is pretty well animated. The tile sets and stuff were not nearly as intricate. They were not nearly as attractive.
But like I said, the thing about Mega Man is cool because you get your boss characters weapon.
That's a cool concept. I don't think I've seen that one anywhere before.
And I think that's why Mega Man ended up doing so well. Once people found out, wow, you can do stuff like that, and the game took off.
That's interesting.
It was known as a sleeper. It started off as a sleeper.
Definitely a sleeper. Not anymore.
Put Shane to sleep.
No, it got Shane's wrist tired because I had to keep going back to the damn beginning. Didn't care for that part of it. Well, that's going to wrap it up for our quickie look at Mega Man from Capcom for the Nintendo Entertainment System, 1987.
I think that's about going to wrap it up for this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Big greets go out to all of our friends and listeners all around the world, including Japan, Australia, Sweden, the United Kingdom. Where else do we have listeners? Canada. I think we even have some Mexico listeners. Greets to everybody. You guys are the best for listening to the show and passing around the good word. Special thanks goes out to SpeedHost.com, our tireless, never-ending host, for hooking us up. And thanks to you, the listener. We love you guys. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio. Brian Smith behind the mixing board. Thanks for listening, and until next month, keep it retro.